You're listening to a news report podcast from thebodypro.com, the HIV resource for healthcare professionals.
I'm Miles Helfand, editorial director of thebodypro.com. HIV therapy is a rapidly changing field. One might assume that more than 30 years of intimate experience with a virus might leave us with a firm sense of precisely how to treat it, but HIV has largely eluded such easy answers. And antiretroviral therapy continues to evolve dramatically, almost from year to year. As a result, seemingly simple questions, such as when do I start my patient on antiretroviral therapy, don't have simple answers. To talk through this most fundamental of HIV treatment questions, we were honored to speak with two of the world's leading HIV specialists. Joel Gallant, a professor of medicine and epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and the associate director of the Johns Hopkins AIDS Service, and Paul Sachs, the clinical director of the HIV program and the Division of Infectious Diseases at Brigham and Women's Hospital, as well as the editor-in-chief of Journal Watch HIV/AIDS Clinical Care. Both men are currently members of the panel of experts that periodically revises the Bible of HIV treatment in the U.S., the Department of Health and Human Services Antiretroviral Therapy Guidelines for HIV-infected adults and adolescents. In the following interview, I spoke with them about the when to start question and related issues. Dr. Gallant, we'll start with you. It really has not been a ridiculous number of years since U.S. DHHS HIV treatment guidelines set 200 CD4 cells as the threshold for starting treatment. And now here we are as of March of 2012. The guidelines have been updated to include a recommendation that people start treatment when their CD4 count is above 500. What has led us to where we are now in terms of the aggressiveness of when to start antiretroviral therapy?
Part of it is that the regimens and medications we have are so much better than the ones we had when the cutoff was 200. We used to expect inevitable toxicity with our antiretrovirals. That's no longer the case. We can usually treat with a single daily dose of medications that are very well tolerated and have pretty minimal long-term toxicity. In addition, I think we've come a long way from the days when we thought that the only bad thing that happened to you with HIV was that you had a low CD4 count and then you got opportunistic infections and malignancies. We now know that HIV is a disease of inflammation, of immune activation, that over the long term can cause medical consequences beyond those of the traditional list of opportunistic infections. And that these things are more independent of CD4 count and more perhaps driven by viral replication, so that there's a benefit to suppressing viral replication regardless of what your CD4 count is. And then finally, and maybe what sort of tipped the scale over to this approach has been the results of HPTN-052 showing that antiretroviral therapy for positive patients is the most effective form of prevention that we have. And so when you combine the benefits to the individual who's infected and the benefits to that person's sexual partners and to society as a whole, it seems like sort of a slam dunk.
Dr. Sachs, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I'd just like to reinforce the last point that Joel said and mention that it has an interesting effect in the clinic, which is that even though it's a sort of public health benefit, this prevention of transmission, it turns out to be very motivating for your patients also. It's really unusual these days to have someone, once they hear that information, say, you know, stale treatment's not for me. Because I guess deep down, people understandably don't want to be contagious to others, and they want to be less contagious. And so 052, even though we kind of knew it was going to work, but still, having those results out there really changed things a lot. One other factor is that there's a long-standing kind of belief that, you know, if you use your treatment now when you're healthy, you're not going to have anything left when you're sick, you know, because the idea that eventually everybody fails. But it really turns out that's not the case, and we now know that over the long term. People who are successfully treated can remain successfully treated probably indefinitely, provided they continue their medications, and that the development of multi-class resistance is kind of a thing of the past and more linked to the inadequate therapies we had in the 90s than really anything about treating HIV.
Yeah, and in fact, there's some studies now that are showing that people who have start with higher CD4 counts are less likely to develop resistance and less likely to develop toxicity than people who start with lower CD4 counts. So that just emphasizes the point that Paul made.
To what extent is that related to an increase in the potency of the regimens that we have versus, say, increased levels of adherence that we've seen thanks in part to the proliferation of single-pill, once-daily regimens?
I think it's both. I think the regimens clearly are more potent, but they're also much easier to adhere to because of their simplicity and greater tolerability. In the past, people could do well with combinations of indinavir and stavudine and lamivudine, but it was really challenging, and the toxicity was really significant. So even the most adherent patients were going to have problems with those regimens. Now, we're typically in clinical trials seeing efficacy rates of 90% or above, which is just unprecedented compared to earlier regimens. And it's a combination of the better drugs and easier adherence.
The other factor is that the use of boosted protease inhibitors has almost eliminated the whole issue of new-onset protease inhibitor resistance. It's really remarkable when you think about your clinic population and who are the patients in your clinic who have triple-class failure, the old-fashioned triple-class failure, and have high-level PI resistance. Really, none of them started treatment after 2001 or so when lopinavir-ritonavir became standard PI. So it's really uncommon to see the new cases like that. They do happen, but they're not happening frequently.
You mentioned HPTN-052 and this increasing awareness that treatment as prevention is a real, actual thing. It's a viable strategy for helping prevent the further spread of HIV. The British HIV Association relatively recently updated its own treatment guidelines and specifically avoided a recommendation that people start HIV treatment at greater than 500 CD4 cells. Dr. Sachs, why are the U.S. guidelines more aggressive than the British guidelines in that
sense? I think it's a matter of degree. First of all, there is unanimity among HIV specialists that if you have limited resources for paying or covering antiretroviral therapy, that you get much more benefit per person if you delay treatment. That's excluding the transmission piece. So if that's the case, then actually recommending therapy only for people with lower CD4s makes sense. But if you look at it differently, if you say, well, we do have the resources to pay for these treatments, and I would argue we do, then there is benefit accrued really along the entire CD4 spectrum. The one that's most obvious are people with AIDS, but then, you know, of course, there's these other benefits at higher CD4s that Joel has alluded to. So I think it has a lot to do with resources. And we have problems with our healthcare system in the United States. No one needs to sort of go through them. But one of the problems we don't have, at least right now, knock wood, is paying for HIV treatment among those who are in care.
I don't know if the people on ADAP waiting lists would necessarily agree with that, though.
Well, you know, let's take a look at that. I think it's reasonable to drill down and say how many people in the United States who are in care are actually denied HIV therapy. And the number is actually very small, even in the worst-case states, you know, the southeastern United States. And I would argue it's much lower than people are denied care for other healthcare conditions than it is for HIV. By contrast, if you talk about some of the very expensive biologics to treat rheumatoid arthritis, or you're talking about neurologic conditions that have very expensive treatments, that's much less likely to be covered than HIV therapy. And one reason why we've been so good at having a system for treating HIV is because treatment is so darn effective, very hard to argue against it. So yes, there are individual cases in individual states where there are waiting lists, but relatively small numbers given the size of this country.
One of the issues is that some of the benefits that we accrue by treating very early may be benefits that you wouldn't notice in the short term. It's not that you're going to prevent people from dying of pneumocystis, but that you may be lowering a long-term risk of things like cardiovascular disease or bone disease. You may not see those benefits for several decades, and of course when people who control the purse strings make decisions, they're not really interested in those kind of long-term benefits. But of course that is also the financial benefit of preventing transmission, since it's obviously much cheaper to prevent a new case of HIV infection than to treat it for life. Paul has more experience with cost-effectiveness analyses than I do, but there's certainly been people who've looked at the cost effectiveness of treating to prevent HIV, and it's generally come out to be very favorable.
Well, if that's the case, then we look at WHO guidelines, which are about as conservative, relatively speaking, as you can get when it comes to HIV treatment guidelines globally. And obviously, there's been a lot of discussion over this I've seen over the past few years regarding the nature of WHO guidelines and to what extent they should be capitulating to public health and policy realities versus just saying this is what people need. You had mentioned just a little bit earlier, Dr. Sachs, that if we have the resources to be able to pay for treatment, that we should do it. Why wouldn't treatment guidelines be irrespective of the ability to pay?
Well, that's a very interesting debate, and whether guidelines should include issues of cost and resource allocation. And I'm of the opinion that introducing that topic is important. But we do live in a finite world as far as resources are concerned. Don't get me wrong. For example, use of tesamorelin for visceral adiposity is not generally covered in AIDS drug assistance programs. But at least here, we have a fairly good system, as fragile as it might be, to pay for treatment for everyone. If you don't have that, and internationally they don't, then they have to prioritize. And there you really do get much more bang for the buck by treating people with more advanced disease. I will say, though, interestingly, there's this paradox, which is that because in resource-limited settings there are more kind of aggressive opportunistic infections that occur at a higher CD4 cell count, the benefit as far as preventing AIDS complications is greater in those settings than it is in the United States, which is one reason why even after the HBTN-052 showed a benefit, clinical benefit for people with CD4s greater than 350, some people have said, well, you know, that's only because those are mostly cases of tuberculosis, but, you know, how can you show that same benefit in Western Europe and the United States where there's much less TB? You know, and that is a fair argument.
On the other hand, there's also greater risk and toxicity to early treatment in a developing country setting than there is here. For example, in most of the countries that the WHO guidelines are written for, typical starting regimens involve D4T or AZT, which we don't use much. If they're monitoring viral load at all, it's very infrequently, so patients often have pretty extensive resistance by the time they've moved to second-line therapy. They're not able to get resistance testing. So in that setting, under those conditions, it probably wouldn't make sense to treat at very high CD4 counts because you're putting patients at great risk for a relatively small benefit. In contrast, here in the U.S., where the regimens are very safe and we have good monitoring, there is a benefit that outweighs the risk.
There's a really nice paper that was just published in AIDS looking at the kind of response to ART in sub-Saharan Africa and looking at how a CD4 greater than 500 appears to confer even a greater benefit there than it does in the U.S. It's a very, very nice paper.
So here in the U.S., the guidelines now unanimously recommend that therapy be initiated at any CD4 count, which is a pretty ubiquitous recommendation. But what are the exceptions to that rule? Are there cases in which a clinician, at the very least on a case-by-case basis, should be second-guessing that as soon as somebody comes into my clinic or my hospital or my practice and is either diagnosed with HIV or just presents with HIV, I need to start them on treatment? What are the exceptions to that rule?
Well, remember, it's not a rule. It's a guideline, a recommendation. And I think one of the most obvious exceptions would be somebody who's simply not ready to start, who either doesn't want to start or who is going to have problems adhering to therapy. In patients with very high CD4 counts, this is never an emergency. So you have time to prepare the patient and to make sure that everything's set up to maximize adherence. And so we shouldn't look at this as something that has to be done on the first visit. Patients need to buy into this and be ready to do it. And then I guess the other exception for me would be the elite controller who has a high CD4 count, the person whose viral load is already undetectable and CD4 is stable and normal. It's possible there could be some benefit to treatment for those people, but it sure is going to be hard to prove it.
How can a clinician know whether a person is going to be an elite controller? Is it necessarily an indication if they present with a high CD4 count, say above 600, and an undetectable or very low viral load, that doesn't necessarily mean they're an elite controller, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely right. I mean, we now, of course, all have had experiences, in particular people with recently acquired HIV, where they start out with very favorable looking prognostic numbers, but we, you know, both by clinical experience and cohort analyses, they get virologic escape from the immune control, and that can occur over time. There's no easy way to tell whether someone's going to end up having that phenotype for permanently. And there are some correlates, like the HLA-B5701, ironically the same one that goes along with the baclofir, and the CCR5, if they're heterozygous, but nothing absolute.
Of course, you don't need to be able to predict the future. You can simply say, I'll treat when there's either CD4 progression or viral escape.
Well, how do you balance? Is there a checklist that a clinician can go down where they begin to say, okay, now the CD4 count is 350. Now I begin pressuring them more. Now I begin to talk to their case manager about getting them more effective support. How do you begin to make that differential between, okay, this person is fine, I don't need to push too much, and this person really needs to get into treatment? Dr. Sachs, let's go with you.
This is going to sound perhaps overly obvious, but there are people that you really have to twist their arm, because you have to kind of remind them that even though they feel well, that HIV is still potentially a fatal condition, and AIDS is a fatal condition, and that in order to avoid that, they have to go on antiviral therapy. And most of the time, you can make the case very persuasively and get people to buy into treatment. I like the way Joel has phrased it before. It's for those people, you know, where the urgency of starting is considerably greater. You could either use, if they're very scientifically oriented, all the science, or you could use pictures. You could use all kinds of analogies, like saying, look, this is like treatment of very severe high blood pressure. You may feel totally fine, but what really we're trying to prevent is a devastating stroke. And you know, getting people on treatment most of the time works. I will say, and I'm kind of rambling here, that there is a subset of people who simply won't take antivirals. And based on cohort studies and based on our own clinic and based on, you know, Ryan White reports, they're probably about 10% of most practices. And a lot of them don't show up, or when they do show up, they're sick. And, you know, it's very hard. And I think one reason it's very hard to manage them is because the causes of that kind of behavior are so diverse. Not just one thing, it's usually multiple things. That sort of gets at some of the aspects of your question.
I think also, you know, patients sometimes come in and are surprised when we recommend treatment, or I hear other clinicians say, well, my patients, when I tell them they should start treatment, they balk at that. Well, of course, they've been taught the lessons that we've taught them over the years, that you don't need treatment until you're sick, or you don't need treatment until your CD4 falls. And when we tell them we're now recommending treatment for everyone, it comes as a surprise. But, of course, we can easily reteach them. They have an infectious disease. We have a treatment for it. It doesn't take a big leap to understand that you should be treating this infectious disease. It's just a matter of sort of undoing the lessons that we've been teaching them over the years, and I think that can be done.
This is probably also an important reminder for all of us that connecting a patient to relevant services, support services, and education services is so critical in HIV. In many cases, it's more than just going to your HIV physician every 3 to 6 months and getting a viral load test and talking about your health, but also being able to be connected to the level of care that can get you educated more about HIV and its treatment, that can maybe get you some help for depression if you're experiencing it, to get help with unstable housing if you're experiencing it, to get help with just taking care of your loved ones and your family if you need it, the kinds of things that can be a barrier to starting therapy in the first place.
Absolutely. And one thing that's interesting, we're doing a quality assurance program, and we got a look at, you know, the proportion of patients here who are prescribed ART, and it was something, I can't remember if it was 93% or 91%. So most of the patients in our clinic are already on, or either on therapy or prescribed therapy. And that actually was reflected in a national study that was presented at CROI this year. So that among people in care, we're already very close to treating everybody. And another way we know that anecdotally is because the basic science researchers we collaborate with are always looking for people not on treatment to help their pathogenesis studies along, and looking for specimens, and it's getting harder and harder for them to find them. I'm sure the situation is similar at Hopkins.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you look at the CDC studies that have shown, you know, anywhere from 19 to 28% of Americans with HIV have undetectable viral loads, the problem is not that they're in care and not getting drugs, or that they're on drugs that aren't working. The problem is they're not in care or they're not diagnosed. That's where our gap is. Once people are in care, they tend to get put on treatment and they tend to suppress their viral loads.
Exactly.
Speaking of getting on treatment and staying on treatment, structured treatment interruption used to be a fun topic of much discussion and debate. Earlier in the last decade, it fell apart due largely to the findings of the SMART study, but also due to just the increased potency and decreased toxicity of existing treatment, making it less likely that a person would necessarily want to stop. There have been a few studies that over the last year or two have started to explore in more detail the idea of starting treatment during acute infection, as opposed to people who are chronically infected and have been on treatment for a while and then stop. These are people who are acutely infected, start treatment immediately in order to achieve a level of viral suppression, maybe a stabilization of CD4 count, and then maybe stop after they achieve suppression after, say, 6 months or a year, and then maybe stop for at least a few years so they don't have to be on meds, maybe reducing the risk of long-term toxicity and so forth, and then maybe restart it down the road. How do you, either of you, feel about that approach? Is there any merit to it, or do we just not know enough yet to be able to recommend that as an actual approach to treatment?
I'm not too excited about it. I think that while there is some evidence that early therapy right after acute infection may delay your need for antiretroviral therapy later, we were doing a study like this, and when the time came for people to stop, they were often doing extremely well. They had high CD4s. They had undetectable viral loads. They were having no side effects. And the idea of stopping made no sense to either the patient or the clinician. I kind of think that treatment interruption studies are a remnant of the days when all we cared about was keeping your CD4 above a certain threshold and nothing else mattered. And I think ever since the SMART study, we've realized that there's more going on than just CD4, that rebound viremia is not good for you. So for me, I just don't see the point of interrupting therapy that's working.
Yeah, those studies that you refer to, Miles, interesting, two randomized clinical trials of acute infection where you had strategies of interrupting therapy. I would be very surprised if any such study could be started today, simply because interruptions have consistently been associated with more harm than good, and there's no reason to really think why acute infection would be necessarily different from chronic infection in that regard. So even though, yes, there was benefit to treatment compared to no treatment, I bet you the benefit would have been even better if they had stayed on treatment. Believe me, and getting back to what you were saying before, we understand that these treatments, even though they're safer, they do have side effects. And one of the big challenges in HIV medicine is managing the long-term side effects of these treatments and knowing, you know, when is the proper time to consider a change, even with virologic suppression. But that's a whole different topic.
Yeah, it's a topic for another day, unfortunately. So where do we go from here? We used to refer to the debate over starting treatment as a pendulum that for the better part of a decade had felt like it swung in one direction against the initiation of therapy due to toxicity issues, resistance concerns, and then in the other direction. And we are about as far in the direction of, yes, go ahead and start treatment as we have ever been. Are we done swinging back and forth? Looking into the crystal ball, where do you guys think we might be headed in terms of when to start? Dr. Gallant.
I think the pendulum's done swinging, but then you always think the pendulum's done swinging. When you always think that what you know now is what's correct, and then you can be surprised sometimes. But I think we're done. The one thing that's out there that we don't know about yet is the START study, which is a randomized controlled trial of when to start, of earlier versus somewhat delayed therapy. And many people really objected to the guidelines moving in the direction that they did without the data from the START study, and they said that this would discourage participation in the START study. While that may be true, I think the guidelines needed to do exactly what they did because the guidelines panelists felt that the information was sufficient to make these recommendations, and it would have been unethical to withhold that recommendation just for the sake of one study. What happens if the START study shows a benefit to early treatment? Well, that will just confirm what we've already done. What happens if there's no difference between early and delayed therapy? I don't think that will change people's minds because many will say, well, the benefits are long-term benefits. You're not going to see them in a trial where your follow-up is 6 years. In addition, it's not going to be measuring transmission. Seems unlikely that the START study is going to show worse outcome with early therapy, but of course, if that happened, that would be a game changer. So I'm pretty comfortable that we're going to stay where we are.
One issue, of course, that has come up with the START study is the question of how representative is it of patients in practice. And that's because when you look at the subset of people who are both A, willing to be randomized, and B, are cared for by providers who are willing to randomize them or refer them for randomization, it may not be similar to the overall group who's out there. It will answer some questions, no doubt. I think it will be fascinating to see what it shows. But again, it may not be the last word on this. The other thing is, getting back to this cost issue, one thing that will be happening over the next few years is an increasing availability of generic HIV medicines. And just like treatment of hypercholesterolemia becomes less expensive when statins go off patent, the same will happen with HIV therapies.
Well, at the same time, though, we have new therapies that are going to be approved. I mean, as of this recording, we've got the quad drug that's right on the horizon that is going to have a pretty long patent life, even as existing first-line meds like efavirenz, for instance, come off their patent within the next, 12 to 24 months probably. To what extent do new drugs like the quad change the conversation at all?
The safer and more effective the initial intervention, the easier it is to start treatment. Clearly, we need longer-term data on quad and more clinical experience after approval, assuming it is approved, to say that that's the answer. But for some people, they don't want to take a medication that has any CNS side effects, like efavirenz, or they may have a viral load that's too high to go on rilpivirine-based treatment. And there's no perfect treatment out there. I mean, obviously, if the medications were perfect, then everyone would be on treatment. It's really moving the field forward incrementally as getting these new options.
Do either of you have any closing thoughts, anything on the when to start question that we haven't touched on or that you'd like to say before we close up, Dr. Sachs?
I think it's important to continue to have these dialogues about this issue. I know that I've heard from some of my European colleagues that they don't find the data as compelling as we do. If we keep an open mind, we're more likely to learn. So even though Joel and I are in agreement on this, I have to allow for that this is not one of those obvious situations like it is when you're treating people with more advanced immunodeficiency.
Yeah, I think the Europeans and the British physicians and guideline panelists very much have to weigh cost in their decisions. They're in systems where there's much more of a fixed pot of money that they have to decide sort of the greatest good for the greatest number, and so it's impossible to ignore cost. In the U.S., we've had the luxury of not having to think too much about that, and we've been able to be sort of purists and just talk about what we think the scientific data show in terms of our recommendations. Maybe we've been deceiving ourselves that way, but my own opinion is that when you consider both the treatment and the prevention aspects and benefits of antiretroviral therapy, we can't afford not to treat people. I do think we have the money to do it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the problems with the U.S. healthcare system are so huge, I don't even want to start, but the reasons why it's so expensive, it does not have to do with antiretroviral therapy. I think that's pretty much all I need to say.
Absolutely. I mean, the antiretroviral therapy may be pricey, but it has been shown to be one of the most cost-effective medical interventions that we have. And that's without the prevention benefit. That's just looking at treatment. You add in the prevention benefit, it just seems overwhelming.
On that sobering but slightly optimistic note, we'll wrap up. Thank you, Dr. Gallant, Dr. Sachs. Thank you so much for taking part in this
discussion. Thank you, Miles.
You're welcome. Thanks.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us. This has been a news report from thebodypro.com. The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us at news at thebodypro.com.